Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We're going into the Torah portion called Vayera, or And He Appeared, and it's covering Genesis chapters 18 through 22. So before we get started, a little bit of prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us your words, and we ask for your Spirit to help us remember the things that you've taught us and the things that we've studied. Help us to put all of your messages together. Help us to understand better who you are and what you want us to do in the world. We thank you for these things. In the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen. So before we get going, just a little bit of an overview before we get into the reading, kind of set the stage. There are some things that we've talked about in previous occasions. You can check them out here at hallel.info/P4, where if you wonder what P4, that's number 4 of the parasha reading. So if you want to go there, there's a collection of all the studies we've done over the years on various topics. So we're going to be zeroing in on just one aspect of the reading today, but there are plenty of those aspects to take a look at. And one of the key things, we've sort of hinted at it before, is in the name of this section itself, talking about And He Appeared. And one of the things that we'll be looking at is this, one of the names that you probably have heard, people have pronounce it Jehovah Jireh, well, or more like Jehovah Yireh, and Yireh is the key thing that we'll be looking at throughout this, and it's a key aspect of it. And Yireh means, will be seen, to see, will be seen. And one of the interesting aspects of that, we've hinted at it before, is you know the passage where it says, the fear of the Lord is what? The beginning of wisdom, the beginning of knowledge, both ways. And interestingly enough, what is the Hebrew word for fear but Yireh? It's spelled a little bit differently, but it's one of those things that is quite interesting when you sort of see the wordplay that happens in Hebrew. You see it in chapter 3 of Genesis and talking about whether someone is clothed or not clothed or ashamed or unashamed. You see this wordplay back and forth, and also with the snake. So how things are pronounced and how they're spelled come into play. And there's, in English, we call it with the big old loaded 50-cent word homonym, which just means it sounds the same. Well, in Hebrew, there's a whole lot of wordplay with homonyms, words that sound or pronounced very similar, but have different meanings, but they connect together. And one of the things that we'll be seeing in here is the interesting connection between Yireh and Yireh, to will be seen and to fear, is what is the beginning of wisdom? What is the beginning of knowledge? That the Lord sees you. Because one of the aspects of respecting the Lord is the Lord actually seeing what's going on? Is he the absentee landlord that people accuse him of being, that is totally detached from reality? Or does he actually see what's going on? That factors in big into the aspect of things going on today. Is the Lord actually paying attention? So one of the things that we'll see is it comes into the big aspect of showing up at the right time. Is the Lord late to the scene on this? Waiting too long? Waiting way too long. Remember the last passage we saw about the promise, starting back in Genesis 12 and going through that promise that came forward. This is quite a bit later. Did the Lord wait too long? Yes.
It's funny. It's funny. Hello.
Oh, sorry.
The microphone's dead. Hello. Hey there, son. It's funny that I run across this periodically. That God, I'm waiting. Come on, yet. Come on, is it ready yet? And then when it says something's ready, like, wait a minute, that's bigger than I expected. Hold on, stop. What? Stop. I'm not ready yet. It's because I'm ready for this much, and he says, no. Now it's this much. Oh, wait a minute, I wasn't ready for that much. I was ready for a little bit, not as much as you as you'd planned. It's funny if we're expecting, but it's when it is ready, we're not.
Yeah, and one of the things that is related to that when you consider, well, is the Lord delaying? Well, where is this coming that you're describing? And it's described as that slowness is not as we would count slowness. But what is the slowness of the Lord? Long-suffering? What is that long-suffering? To just wait until everybody's dead or everybody's become corrupt? Until all come to repentance. That's what's talking about the long-suffering of the Lord. So we'll be getting into a little bit more of that later. Now, another thing that we've covered in previous occasions, the promised one, Yitzhak. Trusting in God's promise to actually bring this forward to a conclusion. And is it coming too late or just right in time? And one of the things we'll be looking at in the outset here is about Abraham's lunch with the Lord and the intercession for Sodom. And one of the lessons we can get from that, we'll be getting a little bit into that today, but it's really from another discussion, is about interceding for others. And even if that involves, you can say perhaps indirectly, interceding for people who you think are so-and-sos. Now, we see in the Psalms, you could argue, well, you see in the Psalms where he's saying, Lord, well, please bring down this, bring down that on your enemies. But it's one of those things where we have to be extremely careful about who we're calling down vindication upon. You ever heard of that? Another 50-cent term is collateral damage. Well, in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, there was collateral damage that could be ensued. And we'll see that as we go along. So one of the lessons is being concerned about the collateral damage to the righteous among calling down condemnation upon the wicked. And praying for mercy for those in places. You know, we were just praying today about Turkey and Syria and Iraq and Iran and North Korea and on and on and on the list goes. About, we hear these little smatterings out about our brothers and sisters who are suffering under this. So one of the things that this lesson we'll be going through today goes into is concern for those people who are in the midst of all this and hanging on. And we'll be looking at the deliverance of Lot amid the judgment and how that factors in. And sometimes we're saved by the prayers of the righteous, not because of how fantastic we are. Is that, you know, the old proverbial grandmother praying for you for 20 years? Well, yeah, maybe there's somebody like Abraham praying for us to come through whatever thing that comes our way. And something that is brought up in this conversation, we've touched on it quite a few times before, is Abraham's offering of his only son that comes at the end of the discussion today. And one of the lessons of that is really not only just showing up, not only just seeing what's going on, but actually delivering to the utmost, delivering of the Lord's presence himself into the solution. Not just seeing, not just taking a passing interest of it, but directly getting involved. So that's a good lesson for us. And well, one of the things that we're going to be focusing on today, wow, we saw some real examples of that here recently in a picture of the evacuation from Windsor. And you know, one of the things that came to mind is this passage from Matthew 25. So it's a part of a longer parable, but a couple of passages in it. And you see in this parable where the people are asking the king, it's like, well, when did we see you a stranger and invite you in, naked and clothe you? And a couple of verses later in verse 40, the king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. So one of the lessons that we have coming down through all of this is that looking out for opportunities to help. You know, some famous people have said variations of the phrase, you know, be the hope or be the change that you want to see happen in the world. That is a lot of underlying what we're going to be getting at into this discussion today about hospitality and really this hospitality in a very hostile world. So some of the things that we're going to focus on here today is, and rather than the ethos that we have, which comes from the Darwinian world, you know, as it one folk called it, nature red in tooth and claw, rather than that ethos is eat or be eaten. What ethos do we see the kingdom of heaven portray? Is that the strong care for the weak and look out for the opportunities to help those who need help. Don't step over them. Step on them, on your path to get out the door. So, and some of what we see, we'll be seeing here, saw with the last passage that we went through, is lech lecha, get going. The thing that we saw there, that Abraham was a immigrant from Ur, there in Mesopotamia. He was a stranger there in Canaan. But heaven really blessed him with not just power, but also wealth and beautiful wife, which factors into this story again here as well. So one of the things that we can get the lesson from this as we get on throughout the Torah and as we go around again, one of the lessons of the 10th commandment about coveting, of reaching beyond that which we've been blessed with, is what other people have been blessed with. Do we seek to grab that for ourselves? Do we get angry? Do we really seek that which is not ours, not part of our blessing? Or people that we perceive as not being worthy? Well, one of the things that we have a challenge in our society today is envy, coveting. Well, they've got so much, they got to share it with other people. You know, why do they have so much? Well, it's, you could say it's quite a similar thing to what Yeshua said to Peter. Remember, they're just before the ascension, they're walking by the lake. And he's saying, well, what about this guy? You know, talking about Yochanan. And he's like, well, if I'm going to leave him alive, what's that to you? That's his blessing. That's not your task, not your path forward. Do what you're supposed to do. As he said, feed my lambs. That's his marching orders to go forward. And one of the things that we see is that Abraham is a role model for righteousness that comes through trust. Well, that faith in God's promises. But one of the things we see through, we saw it a little bit in Lech Lecha in our last Torah portion there, starting in Genesis 12, but we see it again here with this one, is the development of what it takes to trust, become a man of trust, and his growth from fear to confidence. And that might start ringing some bells in your head again, moving from fear to confidence. And like that, one of the things that the Apostle Yochanan goes on to in his first letter, 1 John 4:18 talks about perfect love casts out fear. And chapter 4 of that letter really builds on this idea. What does it mean, perfect love? It's perfected love. And how is that love perfected? By trust. Trust that turns fear into confidence. As you see, like in Hebrews, where it's talking about, we can go through the veil with confidence into the presence of the Lord, not with arrogance, not like we deserve it, but we have been blessed with that path in. So, some of what we see also, we'll be taking a little look at this of Lot in Sodom and how he demonstrated his hospitality to these two travelers, these two angels, these two messengers that are came in with kind of the dual purpose of seeing what's going on, but also, you could say, bringing the full, full weight and power of the kingdom of heaven down upon the situation. So, likewise, oh, here we go. Here's a good 50-cent word for you. Philoxenia. Philoxenia. You probably saw philo, meaning to have love or affection for, and xenia, or that which is other. So love of the other, love of strangers. This is the word that you'll see translated throughout the apostolic writings as hospitality. Demonstrate hospitality. Practice hospitality. It's the word philoxenia. And that is what we'll be looking at today, is this watching out for opportunities to show affections for strangers. And a big issue that we'll be looking at is stranger danger. The stranger danger then as in now. A lot of archaeologists and such have seen this. What is this thing about people sleeping out in the square? I mean, happens then, happens now, today, and some places where, you know, you don't have accommodations or people can't afford them, they go out and they sleep in the square. Well, then as in now, that's a dangerous proposition. And then as in now, people feared what would happen to it. We see an inkling of that when the spies go into Jericho. And they're like, ooh, who are these people? And we haven't seen them before. Are they in here? And then getting a picture, well, we know where they come from. And wow, we don't want them in here. Are they coming to spy out the land? So then as of now, the stranger danger results from a breakdown in trust. And a lot of folk have seen that then as of now, this is an ancient issue, is that when people pack together and they start losing touch with one another, not understanding who people are or caring who people are, you start to have a breakdown in trust with other people. Just recently, there was an article about these folk who moved from California to Idaho and had massive culture shock. You know, people not locking their doors. And then, you know, there was a guy arrived in the middle of winter and it's like cold. And he moves into a house that has no heat. Well, he's like, oh no, what do I do? You know, and suddenly there's a knock on the door and it's his neighbor with a cord of wood. And he's like, you know, so he breaks out his wallet, going to pay there. It's like, what are you talking about? We're neighbors. So he just brought in the cord of wood, started up the fire and heated up the house. And that's just what the culture is in rural America. I know I grew up that way. I don't know if you got the chance to grow up in a rural area where people were, I remember going to visit Tammy's folks in rural Montana, and boy, they were laughing at us, having just a jolly good time about how fastidious we were about locking the doors all the time, locking the doors on the car, the doors of the house. Just thought that was hysterical about how fastidious we were about that, but it's like a breakdown in trust of other people. And that's one of the things that people note when you have a moving from a rural society to an urban society, you have a breakdown in trust. So all of that kind of is a backdrop going to our first section here, we're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 18 and the first 15 verses of it. So Genesis 18, starting in verse 1. Now the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. When he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing opposite him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth. And he said, "My Lord, if now I have found favor in your sight, please do not pass your servant by. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree, and I will bring a piece of bread that you may refresh yourselves. After that, you may go on, since you have visited your servant." And they said, "So do as you have said." So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, "Quickly, prepare three measures of fine flour and knead it and make bread cakes." Abraham also ran to the herd and took a tender and choice calf and gave it to the servant, and he prepared it. And he took curds and milk and the calf which he had prepared and placed it before them, and he was standing by them under the tree as they ate. Then they said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And he said, "Well, there in the tent." He said, "I will surely return to you at this time next year, and behold, Sarah, your wife, will have a son." Sarah was listening at the tent door, which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. Sarah was past childbearing. Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I have become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?" And the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I indeed bear a child when I am so old? Is anything too difficult for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you at this time next year, and Sarah will have a son." Sarah denied it, however, saying, "I did not laugh," for she was afraid. And he said, "No, but you did laugh." All right. The section we'll be taking a look at here, and one of the key things we'll be taking a look at is the phrase that's mentioned up here, "Is anything too difficult for the Lord?" You may have remembered that. That was kind of underlying an issue that became a big problem later on in Israel's history, there at Massah and Meribah. What was the big question that they had there? Is the Lord with us or not? That was like after the crossing of the sea, after the plagues, after water from bitter area, from bitter waters. So on and on and on, provision, provision, provision. And then asking, well, is the Lord with us or not? And that's even coming after the manna showing up. So just going back a little bit to where we are in the world, and it says that Abraham was a stranger, and he came in over there all the way on the right side. You'll see a little thing there in Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, down near the, as you follow Tigris and Euphrates down there, almost down to where modern-day Kuwait is today, is where they think Ur was. So Ur, he moved out from there and then moved on over to the land. There's some ancient highways that they know of. There could be others, but they know of at least a few. So it may have gone up through what they call the Fertile Crescent, up through modern-day Syria and kind of down that way through modern-day Lebanon into Canaan, or it may have come across Arabia, but made that journey, he said, to go out. Lech lecha, go forth, and I'm going to show you where you're going to show up. So he went out and says, not knowing where he's going. And then he ends up in the land. And it's very interesting, in the last portion you went through, you had that division. We see why it was that Abraham is where he is, and where Lot is where he was. And Lot picked the nice area. And it's kind of interesting. He picked the nice area of the valley. Well, when what happened? If you kind of zoom in a little bit closer, this area, the Oaks of Mamre, that's, you know, people have put up various monuments and stuff to where this oak is supposed to have been. It's thought to be about a couple miles north or northeast of modern-day Hebron. So where that is, you know, modern-day Hebron, a couple miles north, somewhere around there, is thought to be where this incident of the oaks are happening. Even people have preserved oaks, although the word there in Hebrew kind of maybe is a different type of tree. But No, it's a different city than Heshbon. Hebron is, you kind of go along the ridge there, ridge of mountains, it goes up toward Jerusalem, Jerusalem. So that is, you could see where Abraham was in the high country. And then Lot went down to, people have been trying to find out, and some people have had ideas of where Sodom and Gomorrah were, but somewhere, somewhere at the bottom end of the Jordan Valley, that's, remember we saw that before, the Jordan Valley. Jordan, Jordan, remember what that word means? To descend. It's downhill. And that is seen where the place where everything kind of collects down at the bottom. Point to it on the map. Well, yes. So this is the Jordan coming up from the top here, the Jordan River, and it empties into the modern day Dead Sea. So somewhere in here, some people have started to say, oh, it's up here because of some modern day things that people have said about. Yes. So here, just north of Hebron, is where these Oaks of Mamre are. So this is somewhere in here where the modern-day Dead Sea is where the valley of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now remember, it wasn't just Sodom and Gomorrah. It was a bunch of cities in the area. It was like a whole metropolitan area. Think of like the San Francisco Bay Area. There's a whole bunch of cities around it. Well, this was a metropolitan area, two big cities in there. Kind of think of like today, San Francisco and Oakland being two big cities, and there's a whole bunch of cities around them.
But so the sea wasn't dead when
Sodom and Gomorrah
were alive.
The sea wasn't dead. Well, when you see the description where we have in Lech Lecha, what did Lot choose? I want to go down where there's a bunch of salt and nothing will possibly grow. That's where I want to go, right? Where did it say that he went? The lush area? Yes, he picked. So Abraham gave him the choice. Go which direction you want to go. And he said, I want to go where the grass is greener. And the grass is greener now where the Dead Sea is. Oh. So it was kind of interesting. Someone just did a calculation here recently and found out, wow, you know, the amount of salinity that's been accumulating there hasn't gone on for a whole long time. So it's a fairly recent thing. So people are starting to come around that, hey, it wasn't always the Dead Sea. Yes.
Yeah, the Dead Sea just means it has no outlet.
Yes.
It doesn't mean
there's
nothing
right.
Living
it
in
is
that.
Dead. There is, when you go down there, it's like, you know, salt marshes. You look around, you see the pictures. Salt marshes around there. That's, they got, you probably got Dead Sea salt products, Dead Sea mud. Great, because very salty, good cleansing, good facial scrubs and stuff like that, because of high salt content. Why is high salt content important? Antimicrobial. There's a lot of stuff that just does not like high salt content, which is where Dead Sea. Because it's kind of very interesting and appropriate today that that has become a just largely uninhabitable area. So very fitting that that still persists to this day. So that's just kind of give you a geographical area of where this is. And I mean, this is highly exaggerated. Here's a highly exaggerated kind of topo view of it. So this is four times as prominent as these features actually are. So when you see those cliffs or along the western edge of the Dead Sea, they're not really that high. This is an exaggeration to kind of show you features of it. So certainly this was up on the high country where Hebron is, looking down into the valley. And when it says kind of seeing the smoke rising, it was kind of seen over the edge of the hill. How? Smoke arising and coming up from the valley. So, very interesting. You get this picture of Abraham camping out because he remained not in a city. And then Lot, it says in their last reading, he pitched his tents where? Toward Sodom. So kind of incremental creep, you know, people starting in the suburbs and kind of moving on into the city. So one of the things that's a little interesting passage in here that kind of gets at what we're starting at with, is anything too wonderful for the Lord to handle? In Genesis 8:15, it says, Sarah denied it, however, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. Here we go with this word again. Yirah, afraid. And the interesting wordplay we hear about what? Being able to see. One of the phrases that we have in the Hebrew is about a idiom for forever, is Leolam, which kind of literally says toward the other world or toward the world, or basically means over the horizon where you can't see it. So this is a very interesting thing about trust and saying, hey, a promise that something is going to happen is what? You may not be able to see it. Which brings up a very interesting passage there in Hebrews chapter 11, which is riffing, you know, it's often, you probably have heard it called the hall of faith, the record of faith of the various patriarchs, the faith chapter. So let's take a look there for again at Hebrews chapter 11 and see here where we have this testifying about Abraham. Starting in verse 8 of chapter 11. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to the place which he was to receive an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Yitzhak and Yaakov, fellow heirs of the same promise. For they were looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, even Sarah herself received the ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, there was born even of one man, and him as good as dead at that, as many descendants as the stars of heaven in number and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. And kind of goes on here riffing on some of the people who have mentioned already. All these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on earth. So that's kind of the interesting perspective. And we'll see this brought into kind of sharp focus with what we're looking at with the rest of our passages here today, because Hebrews 11:1 says, now faith, trust, is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. For by it, men of old gained approval. So with this, we're seeing this venturing out. And again, we're getting this interplay between being able to see and fear. see fear. Well, kind of very fitting when you think about what is one of the things that you do to with animals to help calm them?
Blindfold them.
Blindfold them. There's a number of animals that just really calm down if you blindfold them. Or, you know, even today, the big thing now is what they call the gravity blankets, or weighted blankets. And there is a psychosomatic effect of you being like hemmed in with something and yet feeling secure. Very interesting. It brings up something we talked about a while back about the Sermon on the Mount, the Sermon on the Plain. And if you are on the plain, you can have room to maneuver. But if you're boxed in, it can make you nervous if you've got no room to go anywhere. So that's a very interesting picture that we get of being secure while being in the hand or in the grip of something. So that's kind of where we're looking at today is, do we fear while being in the grip of blindness? Because we can't see where it's going. We can't see where the end part of it. I mean, imagine if you get into a car and the driver puts on a blindfold and hits the gas. You better hope it's an autonomous car, because somebody better be navigating. But with this, in a sense, that is a lot of what these promises are. Like, lech lecha, go forth. Abraham, put the blindfold on and hit the gas. As your destination is, you're going to be shown where it is. Yes.
There's also a dual play there in that we fear if he sees.
That's where
the same principle. It's
fear both. Is the beginning of wisdom.
Yeah,
yes.
So if he sees us, we're afraid. Like, uh-oh.
Yes.
Because what I'm doing, I want them to see. I don't want anybody to see. I'm trying to conceal it. It's the same principle.
Yeah, and that was, when we were talking about the wordplay earlier in Genesis chapter 3, that is a part of the wordplay. It's like, why is there, you know, lack of covering in one case, and there's no shame, lack of covering in another place, and there is shame? What was the difference between those two? There was nothing to see, no stain, no faulty behavior before. There is something faulty to be seen after that, so thus you want to hide. So that is kind of the interesting picture there. And that's why one of those, you get some of the wordplay from the Apostle Paul when he's talking about, boy, I just want to be, you know, revealed and see things. And then you also see the Apostle Yaakov in the book, letter of James, says to see him face to face, not through a mirror or anything dark. You want to see things clearly. But that presupposes that when the Lord does see us clearly, what does the Lord see? That kind of... That is where, you know, that new covenant promise that we talk about, and it's memorialized with the Day of Atonement comes in, is that has been covered. And the promise is that he remembers that he doesn't see those things anymore. Because from the Lord's perspective, he has promised that I will count those things against you no more. So that is why this picture of being able to see, being able to trust, having faith, and the fear of the Lord. That's why they're all wrapped together. And it's because you can show someone reverence and not really care if they actually see what you're doing. You're just like, you genuflect in front of them. And then when you're gone, then you just blah, 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 do whatever. But if you live your life as if you were always in the presence of the one deserving honor, then how different do you behave? Quite different. And if our behavior then goes in a different direction, while we're in the presence, aren't we glad that we have our advocate there who will speak on our behalf? Because what is our desire? To be in the presence of the Lord. Like the prophet King David said, he longs to dwell in the house of the Lord, in the Lord's presence. What? He just like to hang out in a fancy building with nice incense and a barbecue? Yeah. Yeah. Did he just like to hang out in a fancy building? No. It's because of the occupant of that. So, kind of going, moving on to our next section of the passage, we're looking at Genesis chapter 18, verses 16 through 33. Then the men rose up from there and looked down toward Sodom. And Abraham was walking with them to send them off. Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. For I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he's spoken about him. The Lord said, the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to this outcry, which has come to me. And if not, I will know." Then the men turned away from there and went down toward Sodom, while Abraham was standing before the Lord. Abraham came near and said, "Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you indeed sweep it away and spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked. So the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly?" So the Lord said, "If I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, I will then spare the whole place on their account." And Abraham replied, "Now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord, although I am but dust and ashes. Suppose the 50 righteous are lacking 5. Will you destroy the whole city because of 5? And he said, "I will not destroy it if I find 45 there." He spoke to him yet again and said, "Suppose 40 are found there." And he said, "I will not do it on account of the 40. Then he said, "Oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak. Suppose 30 are found there." And he said, "I will not do it if I find 30 there." And he said, "Now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there." And he said, "I will not destroy it on account of the 20. Then he said, "Oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there." And he said, "I will not destroy it on account of the 10. As soon as he had finished speaking to Abraham, the Lord departed, and Abraham returned to his place. Yeah. So this bargain that's going on there. Yes, Larry. Sound like he was trying to get down to Lot and his family?
Yeah, but then the Lord left before he could get to that point.
Well, I mean, yeah, it is kind of interesting because eventually left with 4. But you get the hint in there that there were others in the family too. So maybe it was 10.
Fiancés of the daughters.
Yes.
So there were 6. But
yeah.
It was interesting. What would Abraham have gone for next if the Lord hadn't said, "I'm done with this conversation.
Done with this." Yeah. So it is quite interesting that it's like for the sake of one family or so, one family in whole metropolitan area. And it's like, even though that, because remember back in our Lech Lecha, we had heard from Sodom before, and it's like, yeah, these people are awful. They sin. Yeah, we are still here for the intercession of Yeshua, Mashiach, for us. Yeah.
Yeah, so he left him live, and we're all now still here.
All right. And we also have the promise of what is going to happen with the Mashiach returns. But the interesting point of that picture is, well, what then happens when the Mashiach returns? Yeah, he says, well, we find the faith on the earth. Will we find any trust? Few. So again, we have that situation of, wow, you started with a whole lot, but can you find just a few? Yes.
Come to think of it, all the things that these people saw in the outskirts of Nineveh or the outskirts of Sodom and Gomorrah, there were a lot of people watching that burn up. I mean, sort of like what we were watching, you know, oh no, look, the fires are getting closer. You can see it. We could see him from Healdsburg, you know, at Valero gas station there. You could see the flames over the mountains off of Arada.
Yeah.
And that was so close to our friends, Joe and Amma.
Yeah. Very, very, very scary to see the conflagration going up in the distance.
So do we have something to fear? I mean, you know, is it a warning to us too? I mean, it's getting closer. People say, oh, sometimes the people think, or Christians think, it's time to get out of California. Is God telling us get out of California before we wind up like a Sodom and Gomorrah, the whole state?
Well, it's one of those things that you can also say on the flip side, well, perhaps that those people of God in a place that maybe disregards God on a wide scale is what is a saving sort of thing. So it's one of those things that you never really know unless you get the actual call to, like, get out.
The hearts of the people.
Yeah, well, it's also a very interesting story when we go around to the time period of Yonah, that I think it's the Day of Atonement period, where we traditionally would read the book of Jonah. And when we talk about repentance, there you had somebody go through and kind of also, from his reaction afterwards, sort of half-heartedly giving this, you know, declaration that they were going to be destroyed. There wasn't even a if then. It was, you're going to be destroyed. But they repented anyway. And it turned around. But as you were talking about the ruins of Nineveh, yeah, somebody else did Nineveh in. As someone else did Babylon in, someone else did Assyria in. That's one of those things about where you put your trust and your might. There might be someone with a bigger stick who comes along and takes you out, especially if that is in the Lord's cards to take the power out. Then what really can you do? Yes.
No, you're welcome.
Yes.
In the same token, we all read the Bible many times, different ways, different areas, but when God says he's going to do something, mostly all you really get to do is to delay it. I mean, everybody still gets the same end. So Nineveh still goes down. King Hezekiah still died. All you guys said, well, I'll push that a little bit. That's where you're still going to go. You're still going down. the 40 years in the wilderness wandering. Yeah, okay. You're still going to die. I'm just going to let you 40 years to die slowly. the point is, it's when he says something's going to happen, it's going to happen. All your prayers and the fasting and things you do, all you get to do is just, you can wiggle it out a little bit, give me a few more months or years, or make it a little faster, take me out today. Most part, the Bible is pretty consistent that way. There's never really a complete erasure, because once he makes a judgment, He makes a judgment. God's judged it. It's done. You can push it out on when, but you can't end. You can't make it not happen.
Well, kind of goes to the thing that we've talked about on different occasions about the term that's called the abomination of desolation of the temple. It's happened repeatedly and for a lot of the same reasons, because you have the Lord departs before the building departs. And that is when you talk about delayed judgment, delayed destruction, the things still come. But why do they come? It's because, well, you may, in the case of Hezekiah and other delays of judgment, they do come, but it's because a lot of the lessons and, you could say, the mercy of the Lord are not really seen for what they are for a lasting period of time. Because one of the things that you get in the Proverbs, and it talks about delayed punishment. And what happens from delayed punishment makes the various ways it's translated. It makes the wicked person or the ne'er-do-well emboldened if you delay it. And you get a little glimpse of that in Revelation, where the judgment is stretched out. You see it extended over a period of time, and you actually get an emboldening of the adversary and all the followers of the adversary. So one of the things that you see the Apostle Peter get to it in both of his letters, when he's talking about riffing on the flood, and it's like, well, the flood came, but people are saying, well, where is this great end that you say is going to happen? Things just continue on as they are, up to the flood, up to now. Where's the great coming? It's been delayed. Is it actually ever going to happen? And then people do what? Delayed judgment leads to, you could say, let's party. Interesting. So, one of the kind of key things from this passage here is not only just the showing of the Lord's continued mercy. It's like, wow, this is bad, but even if there are such and such and such and such number of people, and all the way down to 10, that he would spare it. But the interesting thing that you see in this is this, when we were talking earlier about the growth in trust of Abraham over time, moving from fear to confidence. We see this a little bit in this passage here in verses 17 through 19 of Genesis 18. The Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Since, this is the word that the whole thing of following the because, or is in Hebrew, the key. The key to the passage is often with the key. Sorry, a little bit of a Hebrew pun there. The Hebrew letters of looks like a half moon and a yod together is the word key. And it's translated various ways, but that, because, such and such, is almost like a therefore comes in. And it's good to always watch those sorts of things, because you connect it to what is the therefore from. Whenever you're reading through something and it says therefore, it is dependent upon everything that came before it. In a sense, you can almost look at our apostolic writings as therefore, Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, blah, 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 all the way through Revelation. It is what came before it preceding what comes after it. And he says, am I going to hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Because Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. But you'll also see here, I have chosen him so that he may command his children and household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him. So this is a choosing of Abraham, not just to be picky, but choosing to communicate to the whole world, to bless the whole world with righteousness and justice. And that gets into the conversation, shall the judge of all the earth do justly? So in this passage, one of the things that you could say moving from fear to confidence is the Lord's justice actually just? Yes.
I'd heard a rabbi a while back discuss this about the concept that in English, we tend to mix the concept of righteousness and justice as the same thing. And they're actually polar opposites. And that justice means completely fair. Completely fair. You get exactly what you earned, no more, no less. And righteousness has nothing to do with fairness. Righteousness is where your mercy comes in. What's the right thing to do? So with Sodom and Gomorrah, completely fair, you individually select every person of the evil and kill them. That would be completely fair. But the righteous people, the few that are left, Lot, his wife, and a couple of kids, would be to preserve them completely in every way. And then the righteousness side would be, no, save the whole city for the sake of those two, those four people. So because it's a merciful side, the idea that they are you are balancing between what is the right thing to do versus what is the fair thing to do. They're not necessarily the same thing. And it was an interesting concept, which I hadn't really thought about that before, in the way that we get the idea of mercy from the righteousness side. The whole point of if somebody is suffering, yeah, they may be suffering of their own screw-ups in their lives. They made bad choices, whatever. The fair thing is suffer. You deserved it. You did it. You got that's it. That's the justice side. You are completely fair. That's completely equal. On the righteous side, you get your hand down. Let me help you up. I'm showing him what is right in this instance. And the idea where if I were in his shoes, what would I want someone to do for me? That's a righteousness concept, not a justice concept. It's a very interesting way of looking at them. And so I read that, and after having looked at it that particular way, that particular fashion, the nature of Abraham, that he has both within him, and he teaches his descendants that idea of, hey, there is a justice side, there's a righteousness side. They have to balance both to function in God's realm, which makes sense because that's who God is. He mixes both the mercy side, the okay, doing it as you would have done to you kind of a concept, as well as this person deserves a serious spanking for what they've done, and they shouldn't survive from it. Those two balances. If you have just one side, if you just have the doing others you do to them, you would be a permissive society. Well, I would want nobody else to punish me, therefore I punish no one. Well, that's a wrong direction. If you had the other side, no one survives. You just think wrong, everybody dies. Okay, there's some balance between them both to make a functional people, a functional man, in this case for Abraham, and a functional descendants to come after him.
Yeah, and one of the interesting aspects when we talk about righteousness and justice is what you see is kind of the bridge in the Sermon on the Mount, where it's talking about your righteousness must exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees who know the Torah and ostensibly are teaching it. Your righteousness must exceed that. So thus, righteousness and judgment. And it's very interesting, righteousness, translated often from tzedekah. And what do you often have tzedekah also connected with? Good deeds. The tzaddik, the righteous person, also does what? Opens his hand to the poor. So thus, you've got the picture of the righteous person isn't just there with a stick, but he's there with an open hand to reach out to other people. So thus, that's why it's very interesting in this part of where you have this justice coming down upon the Sodom metropolitan area of the Dead Sea Valley, or what became the Dead Sea Valley, and the righteousness and the mercy, the hospitality that's being shown first by Abraham and now by Lot, which is where we're going next. Genesis chapter 19. Yes.
Regarding if I could organize my thoughts quickly here. A country that has both good people and not good people like us. And I'm trying to figure how God would arrange that. And it occurred to me that possibly what I've always wondered about was what has been called the rapture. That would be the withdrawal of the righteous, which means that only the unrighteous would be left. And then what you're talking about then makes sense.
Well, one of the things Yeshua told a couple of parables that relate to what you're talking about. One of which is when he talks about, you probably heard the wheat and the tares, the wheat and the weeds, or that kind of thing. And he's saying, you know, don't go out there and try to pull up the weeds in the midst of the wheat field, because you might pull up the root system of the crop that you want in the process. Yeah. And sort of say, long story short, leave it to the experts. Leave it to the Lord in his wisdom of actually knowing the hearts of everybody. That you just don't go out there, you know, spraying your defoliant, you know, dropping Agent Orange over your wheat field, trying to get your weeds in a little bit. You're going to destroy a whole lot of your price crop with your efforts to defoliate the weeds. So he's saying, hey, let them both grow up together. Let the wisdom of the Lord sort them out. And he says, you know, hey, the angels will come out and they're going to take, and they're going to do the weeding, and they're going to, you know, the weeds are going to be thrown into the fire. So that's one of his parables. The other one is where he was talking about, you know, that they're being two on a rooftop and two in a field. One's taken, one's left. And he's talking about like in the days of Noah. And we just read a little bit ago, back in Genesis, you know, chapter 6 through 9, there with the account of the flood. And he's saying just like in the days of Noah, you know, one will be taken and one will be left. And when we say with the flood, who was left and who was taken away during the flood? Who was in the ark that was left behind? Noah and his family. And who was taken away with the floodwaters? Those who were out. So thus with that, the parable, we have that described as that the, and you see that in Revelation as well, that you eventually have a point in time where you have the Lord will say, hey, you know, the rest of the people don't live again until the 1,000 years are completed. And then you have this final judgment, resurrection, then death and the grave are thrown into the lake of fire, and that is the end of that sort of situation. But until you have that time showing up, we have to be very careful on the, quote, witch hunt, so to speak. Because in our attempt to go after the evildoers, we can destroy a lot of other people with it. And there's lots of historical examples of witch hunts, inquisitions, etc., that have tried to weed out the evildoers. Yes?
I'd just like to say the word rapture is not in the Bible. And also, when it talks about one shall be taken and one left, in my mind, I'm thinking I want to be the one that's left, because they're going to be taking the evil people. So you're better off just to stand still and wait on the Lord.
Yeah,
not worry about running out there. I want to be first.
Yeah, or Noah's example, get on the boat.
Yeah.
Get on the boat while the door is open. Don't be pounding on the doors when it's closed. So we're in Genesis chapter 19. Yes.
The greater Exodus.
The greater Exodus.
Or the second Exodus.
Yes. And
that's when we answer and go when the Lord says, time's to go now.
Yeah, basically being pulled out of everywhere and having the great return.
Right.
And as you can see, the prophets talk about, this is also around a time where there's not only just a great Exodus, there's a great awakening. So it's not just that, oh, wow, we are a part of the chosen people and we get called out of wherever we are. There's also the Great Awakening where people are desperate for answers. And it says that they grab on to the tzitzitot of a Jew and say, hey, we've heard God's with you. They look for the people with the answers to know what's going on, to know what's going on with things. I just was here recently, you're looking at a growing number of people are realizing that the great paradigm that we're taught about where things come from is just totally untenable. He doesn't believe in God whatsoever, but he says the story that we're told about how things work with natural selection and mutation, it just doesn't work. You don't actually get anything new out of it. You don't have any answer for where things come from, but the greater realization is that the story that is being commonly told about how things come to be is just not tenable anymore. Sooner or later, these people will realize they're reaching to a dead end, and they want to go, where do things come from? And they'll be looking for answers. And one of the things that the people of God are called for is to not only be hospitable for those who need help, but also to have answers for those who need to know where things come from, who's actually in charge, what's the purpose in life, etc. So chapter 19 of Genesis. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground and said, "Now behold, my lords, people, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way." They said, however, "No, but we shall spend the night in the square." Yet he urged them strongly. So they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them." But Lot went out to them in the doorway and shut the door behind them and said, "Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like. Only do nothing to these men, insomuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand aside." Furthermore, they said, "This one came in as an alien and already is acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them." So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. But the men reached out with their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. They struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. When the two men said to Lot, "Whom else have you here? A son-in-law, and your sons, and your daughters, and whomever you have in the city, bring them out of this place. For we are about to destroy this place, because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, and said, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city." But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. When morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city." But he hesitated. So the men seized his hand, and the hand of his wife, and the hand of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him. And they brought him out, and put him outside the city. When they had brought them outside, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you, and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, or you will be swept away." But Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords. Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, for disaster will overtake me, and I will die. Now behold, this town near enough to flee to. It is small. Please, let me escape there. Is it not small? That my life may be saved." He said to him, "Behold, I grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town of which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there." Therefore, the name of the town was called Zoar. So that's the passage that we're taking a look at here. So, kind of the interesting picture when you see this. We were talking earlier about kind of the growth in trust, the growth in faith of Abraham earlier. Did you notice what was going on here? It's like, oh, I'm not going to be able to escape. Let me go to this town here. And as we saw on the map earlier, it's kind of there on the eastern side of the valley, kind of heading up towards the mountains, kind of up into the foothills, so to speak. So some of us have experienced that here recently of a dual evacuation, being evacuated from one city, and then you go to another one, and they tell you, oh, you got to get out of there and go somewhere else. So in a similar sort of thing, it's kind of what you see as it goes on in the next section, where it's like, wow, I didn't think he was safe even in Zoar. So he was going to then go further off into the mountains. So you see kind of the mountains on the eastern bank of the Yarden Valley. So that's the picture that we see. And we get another very troubling picture, and we'll just take a look at this briefly. It's very, very similar to this. Yes?
Also an intercessor for this little city, although, you know, he's just thinking of his own skin.
thinking of his own skin.
Yeah, but, you know, he did help those. Were there other people in Zoar or not? I mean, I think there must have been some people.
Yeah, well, there must have been somebody in Zoar.
Otherwise, you know, and the Lord was very gracious. I said, almost cried, thinking about how the Lord was so gracious even to Lot, who wanted to live real close to the violence and all that horrible stuff going on in Sodom. But I thought the trust grew a little bit in Lot, but not much. But when he, you know, he's saying, "Not able, I won't be able to escape, you know, please let me go here." You know, but Sarah laughed. I mean, you know, I know that was supposedly a laugh of just so sheer surprise that, you know, some people laugh sometimes when somebody tells you something awful, and it's just shock type of laughter. But I kind of think that Lot's faith grew a little bit here.
Yeah, it's an interesting picture that we see of your kind of moving forward in trust, but sort of being, as you say, grabbed by the hand and dragged out because he was hesitating and moving forward. Because, number of us here have experienced that similar sort of thing. It's like you're told to get out, but you, in a sense, hesitate. And I know we sort of hesitated for a long time, and you're sort of thinking in the vein of, you know, is this really happening? Is there actually danger? Now, back in 2017, when the fire was actually coming through people's houses, and you know, the deputies and the police officers are grabbing people out of their beds, carrying them out and tossing them in the patrol cars and driving through flames of fire, that's a little bit more of a call to action. Then it's like, okay, get out, and then the fire is going to come down on you. So you can sort of sense that, you know, is that judgment coming? Yes, Larry.
I've heard it said that in the scriptures, when you go east, it's usually a bad decision you're making.
Bad things come from the east.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know, like the tribes that stayed over on the east side of the Jordan that disappeared right away, and Lot going east wasn't the greatest decision. Should go west towards Jerusalem,
right off into
I guess.
The sunset. Yes.
Yeah. Toward, yes. Toward Abraham.
Yeah. Toward Abraham. He decided to go the other way. You know, as you were kind of seeing the terrain, it looked like it probably an easier go heading up the eastern side than the western side. That just depends on the path that you might take. But any other thoughts here before we move on into this? This is if you thought that the other passage is bad, this one is also pretty bad. But it's kind of interesting because it may help kind of give you some ideas of the picture that you'll say that it will be better for Sodom and the day of judgment. So, Judges chapter 19, verses 15 through 21. Now, we'll be back to Genesis. So, Judges 19, starting in 15. Of course, this is picking up in the midst of a story. So, turned aside there in order to enter and lodge in Gibeah. And when they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. And behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. The man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah. But the men of the place were of Benjamin. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, "Where are you going? Where do you come from?" And he said, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Yehuda to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim. For I am from there, and I went to Bethlehem in Yehuda. But I am now going to my house, and no man will take me into his house. Yet there is both straw and fodder for your donkeys, and also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and the young man who is with your servants. There is no lack of anything." The old man said, "Peace to you, only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square." So he took him into his house and gave the donkeys fodder and washed their feet and they ate and drank. While they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may have relations with him." Then the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said, "No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not commit this act of folly. Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out, and you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish. But do not commit such an act of folly against this man." But the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine, brought her out to them, and they raped her and abused her all the night until morning, then let her go at the approach of dawn. And as the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until full daylight. When her master rose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went to go out his way, then behold, his concubine was laying in the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up and let's go." But there was no answer. Then he placed her on his donkey, and the man arose and went to his home. When he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold on his concubine and cut her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. All who saw it said, Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Mitzrayim to this day. Consider it. Take counsel and speak up. Okay, and then goes on to even more troubling things. So, when you're looking at this, it's like, wow, this sure sounds familiar. Sounds just like very similar to what we had back here in the days of Lot. Now, when you're comparing these things together and also take upon this, what then became of Benjamin? What happened there? Near extinction. It's like, wow, this was so bad. So he's like, well, when they're talking about something like this has never happened, or are they talking about the, I could say, his message that he sent around to everybody? Or was it what happened to her, or what he did in throwing her out? I mean, just bad, bad all around. But when you're talking about the lasting message that came through, Benjamin was nearly wiped out because of this. So badly that they, what, had to repopulate the tribe as a result. Yes.
I find it hard to believe that event was an isolated incident. I don't think it was isolated at all. I think at that particular town, much like Sodom and Gomorrah, whom God had heard what was going on there, this was a institutionalized and accepted behavior, repeated thing that happened on a regular basis to travelers in both Sodom and Gomorrah, as well as in the town that Benjamin had. So I forgot the name of the town. Whatever the town was, the Benjamite town. I think it was a continual thing that occurred. The only distinction in this instance is that the Levite brought attention to it. Hey, everybody, the people around that town, I'm sure, fully knew what happened in that town and had been going on that town for probably some time. I don't think it was a, oh, wow, what, this has never happened before, unheard of, never occurred. I don't buy that.
Yeah, that's when you see the next chapter and it starts talking about what the response was on it. That just doesn't come from a, oh my, this is an isolated incident. This is like, all right, this has gotten so bad, we're going to just deal with this and take it out. And you get a little bit of a, when you talk about the rot of the land of Canaan that wasn't fully dealt with, well, you could sort of see what you could, the offspring of that kind of rot is. So, in a sense, you almost have a bit of a Kal Vachomer thing going on here. Well, if you think Sodom was bad, how much more is this so bad that they had to wipe out an entire tribe almost in the process? And if you think that is so bad, then what do you think is then going to happen there at the day of the Lord with Yerushalayim? In the case where Sodom, by comparison, would be treated less harshly. So you see, wow, things have gone downhill to a big degree. But one of the things that you see, and thankfully the prophets give an insight into this, is that there is a remnant that survives this. It'd be interesting to see. There's not exactly a huge connection between these, but you wonder then if what you see in Zechariah, the last few chapters of it, with the two-thirds being destroyed, if maybe something like this has something to do with it. I don't know. But it is a warning, and it's a warning that goes back all the way to what we're looking at here in Sodom. Sodom, when you're saying, hey, you're living in a society that is so bad that you have to reach out and grab the strangers who are coming into it and say, hey, come into my house. You don't want to be in the midst of this muck and mire. Yes.
So you kind of brought it up about the stranger. You know, here we're supposed to be hospitable to the stranger. And in this case, he was being hospitable, bringing in this person. But then why would he call his concubine wayward? Is that your word? Was that your word that you used? Or was that his wayward concubine where he would throw her out there? And
well, it's kind of a sad yeah. sort of thing when you look at the whole story of it, which don't have time to go into. But when you go back in the story of where this whole thing came from, of basically convincing her family to send her back with them. This is kind of like the therefore. His behavior was, you could say, not unexpected from what you see earlier on in the story. So it's kind of like when you see, wow, the situation has gotten so bad that this is a sign that comes down to all the people. Look at how far you've fallen, that this is the kind of situation that you get in. So it is really kind of sad if you get to that part of a society where there has to be a big reset like that. But then we get a picture of what the day of the Lord is going to be like. That the society will get so bad that there has to be a reset on the scale of Sodom, only not just in Sodom, not just in a valley, but the whole world. Wow. Yes.
This reset with just a big button, and you know, just press it.
Yeah, press the reset button. Yes.
Yeah, press the reset button.
Yeah, it's right next to the smite button. Yes, but it's one of those pictures when we were talking earlier about one taken and another left. It's like when you're looking at the day of the flood, there was like only one place in the entire world that would be saved from what would be coming on if you were a person. So let's just lastly close out with just a few things to give us this picture of why this lesson that comes down to us from Abraham with Lot and even goes on further with Rahab and the hospitality that she showed of recognizing from these strangers, the stranger danger to Jericho was very strong. It was, you could say strong for another reason, but it was very strong and they recognize the danger. But in that case, the danger was to their old way of life, the way of life that was going in a bad direction. A couple passages here from John chapter 13. This is in the beginning of this message in the context of where Yeshua is talking about, hey, the world is not going to like you. They're not going to like you. They're not going to like you because you're with me. And as you see with the people of God, like prophets in general, the prophets of God are not liked. Matthew and Luke go on to detail what happens to the prophets. The old shoot the messenger, yeah, they shot a lot of messengers of God. John 13:20, truly, truly, I say to you, he who receives whomever I send receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. But that you have to predicate upon, do you recognize who actually sent? That's where, when we were talking earlier about testing the prophets, when you test the prophets to make sure who they come from and who they say they come from is actually who they come from. So, a passage here from Hebrews chapter 13. Let love of the brethren continue, but do not neglect to show hospitality. That's, remember the great word? Philoxenia. Philoxenia. Fear of those, or philokinia, if you want to get more precise. The fear of the outsider, the fear of the foreigner. Show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. And that should be ringing bells in your head of this particular incident that we read in Vayera here today. So that's where we'll kind of close out things today. I hope you see that within this passage here, Vayera is something that's very important here today. So if you were going to say a Kal Vachomer lesson that we've all had with these fires here recently, if you have had so much compassion to be taken in or have taken in another family who had to flee from the fire, how much more should we be looking to take in people who are fleeing from a bigger, quote, fire, the world being on fire? So, and also people who have more temporal needs around us. So we could say this is a small lesson. Hopefully it's not lost on us here today, but also those around us that we talk to on a regular basis. That this lesson of Sodom, the lesson of Lot and Sodom, the lesson of Abraham with Sodom and Abraham with Lot, that's not lost on us when we see a world that is in desperate need of intercession. That those who are righteous among these various places are actually a beacon. You know, that we don't just run away and leave people to go up in flames. So any last thoughts as we close out here? All right, let's close with prayer. Father God, we thank you for teaching us through your servants throughout time. And Father, we thank you for giving us your words, for giving us your messengers. And Father, we thank you for helping us to remember the things that you've taught us and to put the things that you've taught us into action so that we walk out your words. We thank you for all these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.